The theme for the evening talk is this world of mind and body. In the opening talk with you, I spoke about the mind and body as a vehicle, as an instrument for making contact with the world, for the perceptions and the world of sight, sounds, etc. And also, and rather unusually and remarkably in the field of existence, we have as human beings the exceptional capacity in life to bring awareness to bear on our very own existence. We can actually attend to our existence. We can look at it. We can investigate it. And it's been widely acknowledged in the field of sentient beings that it's a rather rare and precious opportunity to actually have this, and this capacity, this ability. And to some, and quite some degree, it reflects what it is to be a human being. Unfortunately, there are not enough human beings on this earth, and what we actually have is a lot of human doings and human running afters and human craving and human desiring and etc. But human being, sometimes it would appear in this world of 6 billion of us that there's not enough sense of what being really means, and for that sense of that, it does require one step to stop. S-T-O-P, stop. And in the moment, in the time, and in the period of the capacity in life to stop, and to really stop relatively and ultimately, I'll touch on that later, really, then we have a real chance in life to stop, look, and see. Stop, look, and acknowledge. And therefore, the relationship to body and mental life, body and feeling life, comes to be an object of interest. What is it to be human? What is it to exist? And here you and I, we enter into this world, we pass through it. None of us know how long nor short our life is. None of us know whether we've completed 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 90, 95, 99% of this life. Who knows? And so here we are, we're in this field of existence. We're living human beings, we're sentient creatures of this earth, and we have this capacity to be conscious, to actually be conscious. And in that, we can therefore turn our attention to expressions of what we call ourself, which is rather important and it will take your attention. Here we have the capacity to be conscious of what we call ourself. And we call ourself our heart, mind and body. This is what we call ourself. And now calling it ourself is a shorthand, is a simple way of communicating between human beings. So instead of saying this heart, mind and body right now is expressing language or whatever, one says, I am talking to you. And therefore the word I and the word self, nothing special about it whatsoever, is a simple way of referring to organic life, sentient existence, human being. We could refer in terms of the language of I and self. But it's rather extraordinary, isn't it, that in this world of mind and body, we can actually attend to it. Extraordinary thing. Just to stop in life and to be still in the moment and say, what on earth is this? What is it? And so when we attend to the outer, which we call body, outer, we say, well, what is this body? And in attending to it, initially we say, well, it's organic life, it's elemental life, it's all very simple and basic enough. But do we really see it just as a demonstration, a manifestation of elemental existence, of the interactions, of events, of genetic composition, of combinations of consciousness with earth, air, fire, water, however we might want to describe it, flesh, blood, bones, sinews, hair, or whatever? Do we just simply, purely, directly, just see it as that? And a little bit less of I, me, my, and self. Some of you will know Ram Dass, maybe directly or indirectly, or whatever. Last March, Ram Dass, who's been and made one of the finest contributions in the West to appreciation of specifically Indian spirituality, Buddhist Hindu traditions, etc., was sitting at his computer in Marin, in his apartment there, and while sitting there, had a stroke. Pretty bad stroke, this rather wonderful man had, and was alone for 5 hours, and so several hours went by before anybody found him, and of course was immediately rushed to intensive care. And the effect of all of this was that with the stroke, severe paralysis, loss of speech, and quite and utterly incapacitated. Yes. Human being, living a caring and conscious life, made a wonderful contribution to service, has sent thousands of people on insight meditation retreats with the teachers at IMS in Barrie and on the West Coast and elsewhere, and inspired tens of thousands of people. And in the organic process of events, he has a terrible, terrible stroke. And in the ironic circumstances of life, when Ram Dass had the stroke, he was in the middle of completing a book on conscious aging. How life is inexplicable in its circumstances. And when I was and it's been a very slow, gradual recovery. Some speech is coming back, some movement is coming back, contact is coming back in a very, very slow, gradual way. And he sent a note to teachers and friends at the Insight Meditation Center in Barrie, Massachusetts, and it was a thank you note. And he put in the middle of his thank you note a simple one-line statement which said that he hadn't forgotten that he knows that his body is not himself. That he knows. So despite paralysis, despite loss of speech, despite all the consequences of all of that, something was known throughout. Something was known clearly which wasn't forgotten. And in the awareness and the teachings and our practices here as well, equally important and equally significant, is that we attend to bodily life, we observe it as well and as clearly as possible, and we see it as well and as clearly as possible as organic life, as vibrations, as sensations, as a formation out of existence, as a manifestation of organic expression there. We try, we endeavor, we look to see it as that and not as me, not as mine, not as myself. Because if we see with that clinging approach of self, fear will be lurking in consciousness with every sickness, with every flu, with every anxiety, with every amoeba, with every hepatitis, with every bit of aging, balding, greying, and all the other thing that goes on in organic life. Why? Possessiveness of, ownership of, thinking it's me, myself, and who I am. It is not who you are. If you don't hear anything else for the rest of your life, just remember that. And no matter what you hear for the rest of your life, if you just remember this is not who you are, period. Never, even if you never asked another single question about who you are, never mind. This will be enough for one lifetime, I promise. This bodily life is not who you are. It's whatever it is, but it's not who you are. And that doesn't mean to say, in that perception, in that observation, that there is any withdrawal. Actually, those who think the self is the body tend to live in the relationship of clinging and withdrawing from, grasping onto and alienation from. And that's why, specifically and rather strictly, and not easily, I know for you, that we place throughout the course and duration of each day, sitting, walking, standing, reclining, and eating, which for some is the high point of the day. And in the four postures, it's all of which is a clear reminder, no withdrawal, no distance, no alienation from, no cutting off from, no denial, no running away from, not for a single moment in the course of the day, but to make as many moments of the day as clear as possible. Here is bodily life showing itself. It's not me, not myself, yet there is an intimacy of connection there. There's a knowing of. There is a being with, without fear. And to get that very, very clear through health, through sickness, through beauty and ugliness, through loads of energy and no energy, through birth, through pain, through bodily pleasures of life, through death. Let me just see. Here is this process. I'm not withdrawing from it on one extreme. I'm not clinging and possessive around it, which is the other extreme. And I'm just seeing it as it is. And so that wise instruction of the Buddha that's gone on for 2,500 years still goes on. Please, please, please see body as body. See organic life just as organic life. And obviously, sometimes when we do the normal ablutions of the day, what do we do normally? Well, we go to the toilet. That's a good example of what I mean here. And for some, it's the only experience of letting go that goes on the retreat, but nevertheless, we have to start somewhere. And so there's the cycling and recycling going on. Starts at one end and ends at the other. And that's the daily ritual. And we're glad when it starts at the beginning, and we're glad when it goes, because we don't want to be constipated. So the cycle goes on through organic life and the very process of it. And all of that is seeing and awareness of body as body. When sitting, when standing, when walking, when reclining, when eating, be with bodily life for that. And as was said previously, none of us asked to be born the shape we are, the colour we are, the form we are, the gender we are, or whatever. Just in the dependent arising circumstances, this is what shows itself. Therefore, it comes, therefore it goes. If we're clear about it, much of the fear, worry, anxiety, and self-judgmental images of ourself will go. If we're clear about body as body, it will go. And we won't be waking up in the morning, which is the worst time of the day to look in the mirror, and look in the mirror and feel just awful, based on some perception in a totally groggy condition, and feeding all of one's worst fears because one has got out of bed and the only thing that one can find is a mirror. So, the image is not who we are. This is not who we are. In the practicalities of the meditation, in any of the postures, or any one of us, of course, it can be that pain arises. And you and I can say with mantra-like precision, This is not me, this is not myself, this is not who I am. It doesn't mean to say, just in saying that, the pain is going to dissolve into the ether. And so sometimes, as some of you have pointed out in the small groups, that one brings awareness to features of the body, and it does, as well as the mind, and it does seem like, and it's not easy, I know, it does seem like that in bringing more awareness, it, as it were, makes it worse. And that one wish one had never heard the word awareness before, or mindfulness, or being conscious, or meditation, and one much preferred the old totally deluded condition. But nevertheless, you're here. And with the stripping away of the externals, it's intended so that the world of mind and body stands out. That's why so much else is in a way removed and taken away from us. Why? To make something else in the scheme of things stand out extraordinarily clearly as we dare. And what's we dare to make the mind and body really stand out for what it is. When it stands out with the body, times the various pains that you experience, through your own practice and through your own experience with it, there is, I mean, varieties of ways to work with it, but two worth attending to. This is when one has pain in one's body in life, which is dependently arising in all sorts of circumstances. And one helpful, hopefully useful way is to bring, not easy, but to bring as much as possible some space around the pain. You're, say, doing the standing meditation or whatever, or sitting, whatever, and pain arises. And the immediate thought and confirmation of pain is quite often the desire to get rid of it. The mind confirms it as pain because the mind wants to get it rid of it as quickly as possible. And can we forget the wanting? Listen to this. The welfare of your life depends on it. Can we forget the wanting and attend through presence, through being here and now, in a relaxed way, to pain, wherever it is in the body, and have, not easy, some sense of space around it? It is just pain in that locality, in that area. And sometimes when people come in the small groups, whatever, they say, I'm experiencing so much pain in my knee or back or head or other part of the body or whatever. And sometimes I ask, is there life outside of this pain? In other words, there can be such a restriction that there's no space around it. And all that we know is that the consciousness has become restricted and contained and defined by one single locality in this entire universe, my knee. And nothing existing outside of it. The whole life, the whole damn retreat relates to what goes on in the knee, apart from lunch. And the mind, in that, one asks oneself, can I experience life of the pain? Yes, to acknowledge it, maybe to see its change, maybe to see and feel it. And, as I said, simultaneously have some space around it. The pockets of pain in life, given the vast field of existence in which you, are, and you and I live, are actually in places and points. For all humanity, looking at it rather brutally and roughly, actually it's in places and points. It's in places and points in the body. And in that, one of the ways of meditation, sitting, standing, walking, or reclining, whatever it might be, there is pain. Can I, for once in my life, stop fighting it, stop resisting it, stop trying to control it, stop trying to get rid of it, stop running away from it, for once in my life, sit, whatever the posture is, be with the pain with some space around it. I actually have a sense there's more to life than that locality. And if that can, the appreciation and the understanding of that can come through, then pain in life and all the manifestations that human beings have to deal with will never totally control and dominate and persecute our existence. And sometimes you and I, we meet people and we wonder, how can she accommodate that? How can he accept that and be with that? Some of the most life-threatening things in which one would think the whole of the life is going to be totally consumed in the struggle for continued existence. And some people have let go. Some people have genuinely surrendered. Some people have genuinely, naturally, organically given up the holding. It may not have changed the pain, it may not have changed the sickness, the life-threatening circumstance or whatever, but there has been some, sometimes spontaneously, sometimes through awareness, sometimes through instinct, through realization, that none of it's worth holding on to. And the outcome of it, in the being, in the human being, is a spaciousness around one's own existence. And over the years, there have been plenty of people worldwide on the retreats who have said to me, Christopher, I've just got a few days left, a few weeks left, a few months left. I don't know how much longer I've got. I've got this life-threatening illness, etc. And the person says, do you know, I'm so grateful. I'm so appreciative that this happened. It woke me up. It shook me up. I've stopped taking anything for granted, anyone for granted, and certainly I can't take anything of my life for granted there. And there's suddenly an extraordinary sense of space in my life, which I never really knew before. What has happened in the wonder of the human being that something comes through, and in the most awful circumstances, which we wouldn't wish on any person on this in this world, that these things happen to people in the organic life there, and it's brought out of somebody something beautiful and liberating and freeing and enlightening in the best sense of it. The clinging went. It went. It went. Even though the event from head to toes didn't. And we're saying, hey, while we have some degree of health, while we have some degree of awareness and capacity, let's not chance it that in some future date we're going to be all ready for some great awakening when we're on death's door. Poh, you'll be lucky. It can be an absolute horror and a nightmare. Therefore we say, right now, in this day, let me see one useful, helpful, beneficial way, say, when I'm experiencing pain, can I see some space around it? Can I have a sense of it? It's not the only thing of existence. And the other response, and there I say, through practice, through experience, through exploration, we experience pain arising in the body, and it can be useful to direct and turn the attention specifically to the locality. Where is it strong? Where is it weak? Where are the edges of it? Where is the very center of it? In focusing single-pointedly on the pain, is contraction and reaction taking place in another part of the body? Can I allow other parts of the body to relax so I'm not fighting what is arising? Can I practice, bring awareness and relaxation so that I'm not fighting what is arising? When we fight what arises, we create this terrible duality, this terrible tension of being there. And sometimes, as I say, with that, can we just explore it through in a focused, concentrated way? Whatever it might be. Sometimes we might find any moment of pain arising, anywhere. Not just in the postures, one might just be standing in the food queue, and one's some of you barefoot, and the feet are cold. One might have the pleasures of the cold shower or the lukewarm one, and the mind and the body fights it. Can one just be with it? All sorts of small situations, the desire can come up. One goes and takes one's food, and then the mind comes up to make a second pilgrimage back to the pot. And knowing that the others who kindly serve the food have gone, so now one really can dig in. And it may just be, in fact, the wish to avoid some unpleasant sensations in the body. Oh my God, I won't have enough to eat, and I'll be so hungry by tea time, and all the reasoning starts fear and anxiety about the future. Again, can we just be aware and say, am I willing just to be moderate? And when, if I see that movement, desire for more come, can I just see it come, see it go? And yes, there may be some unpleasant sensation. There may be some ripples of anxiety arising or whatever, and say, okay, look, can I just even just open my perception out a little bit? Look around me. Look out there on the other side of the wall or whatever. But it's not necessarily that we have to kind of extend our perception to suffering humanity. Sometimes just for the balance and the practice of equanimity, that means keeping even-mindedness. And therefore, can I learn to be with unpleasant sensations in my stomach? Can I just learn to be with them? They're not that big a deal, are they? But I'll need the practice of regular stopping in the moment so that there is enough sense, enough clarity and awareness in life that I can stop and be still before I'm pushed along by the habit. Pushed along in unmindfulness, in unawareness. Sometimes with the food cue, which is, one says, oh, it's the peak experience of the day, etc. But that doesn't necessarily apply to plenty of people. And for some, it's a very difficult period of the day. There is the length of the queue. And some are there, of course, half hour before. Some start queuing right after breakfast. But anyway. And then there are those who are at the middle, and then there are those, of course, who are at the end. Somebody has to be at the end of the queue. It's just not possible for it not to be like that. And then all sorts of fears and anxieties will be arising. Will there be any chapatis left or dahi or whatever? All sorts of views and opinions about those greedy dogs up the front. And so life in the queue can be hard life, and it's all mind reaching out for body, and how that can take place in just waiting in a queue. And sometimes one might need a little reflection from the rabbi from Nazareth 2000 years ago, who said, "The last shall be first." That is a wonderful non-dual, one-line truth, which those of you in the back of the queue tomorrow can contemplate when... that sometimes the mind which is running and grasping for, in the so-called delusion of fulfilling bodily needs or whatever, may be overlooking and missing on a very deep and wonderful truth of life, as Jesus said at the wedding feast, "The last shall be first." What's he speaking of here? What's he talking about here? And so sometimes just to stand in the queue and say, what's the truth of what's being pointed to? Something very beautiful, very profound, and if one touches it deeply, it's not intellectual, if one touches it deeply, it will transform one's whole way of looking at the notion of first and last. A whole different way of looking at things, free from typical conditioning. Free from typical conditioning. Sometimes, as we know, there's been a fair degree of work on this in the world of mind and body, that there is an understanding taking place, sometimes more theoretical than practical, that mind, when I'm speaking of mind, I'm talking of heart, feelings, thoughts, perceptions, views, opinions, ego, awarenesses, etc., has a relationship to body. So though at the present time, primarily, we give attention to the bodily life, sometimes the bodily experience touches on deep levels in the psyche. And it's no easy task to learn to accommodate and understand that interaction. So as an example, and quite common, with the very unusually cold days here, 3, 4, 5 degrees Celsius as it has been, and with the ranges of flus, coughs and colds, and all of that takes place here. It's tiring, it's exhausting, and it has an impact. And of course, quite often the thought has arisen for a number of you. I want to come on a retreat, and I obviously want to be healthy, and my bodily condition is stopping me from getting on with my retreat. And if I didn't have this bodily condition, then I would be so much better off, and then I could go deeper. This is called useless thinking. And we're dealing with what is, what actually is. And what is that the body is sick. There is a state of unwellness. And of course one does the appropriate, make the pilgrimage to Peggy's room, as a number of you are doing, and take the appropriate and wise and necessary steps, of course, all of that there. But even as you know, you can do all that. And it will, we hope, contribute as it has for some of you very quickly and significantly to the healing process. But you've still got a mind, and this mind is still related to the body. And what's the mind's relationship to sickness? What is it? If there is identification with it, the sickness will enter from the outer more and more to the inner. When we will begin to, this is where the I comes in. Oh, I feel so unwell. And it gets in a little bit deeper into the psyche. It begins to run a little bit deeper into the psyche. And this is making me feel very distressed. And I don't know if I'm even going to be better by the end of the retreat. And it's really now getting to me. What's getting to one? So it goes from the outer, common, several of you have spoken of this, it goes from the outer, and gradually it begins to infect inner life. And one begins to feel unhappy, feel worried, distressed, tearful, overwhelmed with problem, etc., etc. And it's given, the self, only the self, has given immense authority to, putting it brutally, is just a whole stream of very unpleasant sensations. No matter how many times the snot runs down your nose and onto your shawl, it's just an unpleasant sensation to experience and equally to observe. No matter how many times there's a rising from within and it runs up through the chest, it comes out through there and one starts coughing or whatever, or one gets the chills or gets the sneezes or whatever, it's definitely unpleasant. Whether one is a Buddha or the supreme expression of stupidity, it's still unpleasant. And that unpleasantness, our practice is to leave unpleasantness as unpleasantness. Not to take it any further. Not easy. No one would say it's easy. But living there every time, something's going on. And then we grab and we internalize, and then heart and feelings. And so. But we can say all this, it sounds all very sweet and easy, I know. But life, it doesn't necessarily go in such sweet and easy ways. So therefore, at times, unpleasantness is going on in the body, the health situation. We're very vigilant about the future thinking. There's nothing towards healing, anxiety about the future. What do we do when we're feeling unhappy? Feeling problematic? Feeling burdened with a circumstance? And the resources, as has been said previously, one is one must work with it. And that working with it can take different expressions. But certainly the motivation and the intention to work with the difficulty. Can I be in a situation in which I say, okay, I really have an opportunity to address and accommodate this unpleasant experience which I'm feeling? Can I do the same as with pain in the body? Can I bring some space to it? It will pass, we know that. Any states of mind, they arise and they will come and therefore they will go. If we understand that well and clearly, then we can begin to see they arise in order to go. The whole function of things to arise is for them to pass. And if we have more space around it, thank goodness, the quicker the passing. So if we can really give care and attention to arising and passing, it will help to generate that little bit more space around the state of mind. One of the wonderful attributes of the mind, it has its own kind of power in this way. So as an example today, you might look at your mind and say, well, I look at my mind, including feelings and emotions, the whole gamut of inner experience. And one might say, well, today has been absolutely the pits. The pits today. The place has already started a two-class system, those with hot water and those with cold. And various others. So anything can be used for feelings, views, whatever. It may be about the past, it may be about the present as an example, it may be about the future, or whatever. And one can kind of go along with it. Difficult day, negativity, boredom, agitation, stuff coming up which one rather didn't have to deal with, etc., etc. And one rather, obviously, say, I'd rather have something else. But in a way, sometimes we haven't really asked ourselves about whether we really are committed to seeing it through, what the Buddhists would call seeing the emptiness of it. Sometimes we don't even ask ourselves. Whatever the mind state is, whatever the little inconsequential, unimportant, as it all is, dance that goes on inside. Whatever what is it? Some feelings, some thoughts, some memories, some images, some ideas. It's all very nothingness, isn't it? And if we can just sometimes ask ourselves, as I said previously, look at it. It's just a little unpleasant entertainment for the day. It's just a little arising in the vast web of existence. What on earth does one want to make a fuss about it? About anything? So, let's say, the Buddhists say, see the emptiness of it. It's like the Buddha said, one picks up an onion and you peel the onion. All right, you look at the onion, you peel it, your eyes get watered. Unless you've got a matchstick in your mouth, it's not a bad idea. And no one peels again and peels again and it peels and peels and peels to nothing. So all this extraordinary interactivity that goes on, which we call body and mind, in this case, mind life, mind stuff, mind state, mind experience, mind expression, what is it? And if we've, in our meditations, just have for a few moments, I'm not asking too much here, just a few moments of just a few single moments a day of clarity, in which one says, nothing going on. Nothing. Pop out. out of the knee, a bit of sensation here. Nothing really going on. Nothing. Close one's eyes. Just darkness with a few white spots from those lights. And one might just touch, one might just get an appreciation. Hey, this life is a small event. Why do I want to make such a fuss? Why do I want to cling to a little bit of darkness with a few spots? And a few odd sensations. Why would any intelligent person want to make a fuss about it? Why? And yet one is intimate with it. One knows it well. One takes a genuine interest in the manifestation of life, in the formations of life, the appearances of life. One feels a great deal of love and compassion and concern for those who believe in the inherent existence of life and suffer and anguish over it all, and such a tragic misperception of existence. But if we genuinely just stop, as I said at the beginning, genuinely take a single momentary glance at it, where's the problem? Show it. Where? Where is the damn problem? There isn't one. Show it. You say, hey, this world of mind and body is no problem. No problem. Just life manifesting itself. Extraordinary, marvelously, miraculously, inexplicably, but nevertheless, just manifesting itself. And there's just a little pocket here, a little bit there, a little bit there. Just a little congestions. But as I say, one single quiet moment of looking reveals the emptiness of the idea of problem. If that emptiness of the idea of problem is just once understood clearly, it can take away the whole problem of existence. One moment can finish the whole problem of existence in one go. Oh, wonderfully liberating. And what comes after that? Mindfulness of breathing, walking up and down, doing one thing in life, whatever it is, letting it unfold in life. No problem. One's seen through it all. May all beings live with insight. May all beings see into the appearances of life. May all beings live a free and enjoyable life. So let's have a couple of quiet minutes, shall we, please?